Morning. Today's daf and Shabbos Ayin Tess. We are nine Chesamud Beis. We are starting Tana Rabbanan. It is about a third of the way from the bottom of the Amud. First words of the line are Hacha Beis Achiza, and we are continuing our discussion from yesterday regarding Hotzah, carrying on Shabbos, and we're talking about the various items and the various shiurim for carrying these items. This is going to be the topic of the eighth parak here in our Masechta. Already began at the end of the seventh parak. A discussion in which the Chachamim gave an assessment in terms of when the items are chashuv, when they're significant, and therefore when they hit the threshold of being chashuv, being significant, one is going to be liable for carrying them on Shabbos. The Mishnah on the bottom of Ayin Ches Amud Aleph, yesterday's daf, went through an assortment of items that the Chachamim gave a shiur for. One of those items is going to be a piece of paper that has kesher mochsin, that has a receipt. A tax collector is coming in and making sure that you pay the receipt. Right now, we're basically describing something like a toll bridge. And in order to cross the bridge, there's an owner of the toll. Usually it's the government, but it could be that it's private ownership as well. Whatever the case is. And you are now looking to show that you paid your toll. And so what you do is you pay, and you're given a receipt, and this is what is described as kesher mochsin. And this receipt obviously is going to relieve you from having to pay again, because it has proven that you already paid. The Gemara now is going to be quoting a braisa discussing this topic in greater detail, and we are starting on Ayin Ches Amud Beis. Tanu Rabban, the Gemara quotes a braisa. Hamotzi kesher mochsin. A person who carries kesher mochsin on Shabbos, ashelo haro lamochez chayev. If you have not yet shown it to the tax collector, meaning this is proof of payment, you haven't yet shown it to the tax collector, and so therefore for you this item is extraordinarily significant, as it is going to prove that you already paid, so at this point in time now it's chashuv, and therefore if you were to carry it out on Shabbos, you would be chayiv because of its chashivas. Mishahara lamochis, however, once you've already showed it to the tax collector, and so now you've already proven that you paid, so Pater 1 would be exempt from taking it out, because at this point in time, it has no value whatsoever. Your proof that you paid has already been shown to the moches, and so there is simply no need for you to have this piece of paper anymore. It is now a worthless piece of paper, and therefore one is not going to be liable for carrying out on Shabbos. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Af Mishahara lamochis chayiv b'mishat tzarech lo. Rabbi Yehuda is of the opinion that even after you showed it to the moches, you're still going to be chayiv for carrying it out. My Benau, the Gemara now wants to understand what is the nature of the debate between the Tanakam and Rav Yehuda. Why, after having showed it to the Moches, so the Tanakam says now it is rendered a worthless piece of paper because it has served its purpose. And meanwhile, Rav Yehuda, on the other hand, says no, even after you showed it to the Moches, it still is going to maintain some sort of value by which, if you were carrying it on Shabbos, you would be chayv. What is the point of the debate? Not the point. But what is at the core of the debate? So the Gemara is going to give three different explanations. We start with Abaye. Amar Abaye, Ikebena Rita Muchsa. So Abaye's explanation is Rita Muchsa, literally the running tax collector. Rashi describes it like an auditor, right? Rashi uses the words Koranas. It seems to be some sort of auditor. And Rashi's description over here, I'm going to read some of the Rashi inside, in this case, all the Rashi. Sherazanachar Ovrim Ha'alil Aleim Shalonasnu Ameches. So what happens is that you have these auditors who are just keep running back and forth, wanting to see if everyone actually paid their taxes. The alila that Rashi describes over here is it's almost like they're trying to catch you. And v'tarech la'ovrim lachzor lamoches. Now, if you've already shown your receipt to the tax collector, so you just simply say to the auditor, okay, let's go to the tax collector and let's ask him, because he will, now assuming of course he's going to tell the truth, he will verify that I already paid. And according to the Tanakama, so you're going to do that. And according to Rav Yehuda, you're just simply going to hold on to your receipt. And that way, when the auditors come and get you, you're just going to simply show it to the auditors. And Rashi over here writes exactly this point. And so over here, the debate over here seems to be somewhat of a what's more pragmatic. According to the Tanakama, it would just simply be easier if we went back to the Moches. Not sure why, but that's according to the Tanakama. And therefore, after you show your receipt to the Moches, you are now going to be relieved. An auditor comes and stops you. You'll just take him back to the Moches. And whereas according to Rav Yehuda says, no, what you'll do is you'll hold on to your receipt. And therefore, when the auditor comes and tries to charge you on not having paid your taxes, you'll just simply show the auditor. So even after you've shown the receipt to the tax collector, it still is going to have value for you because you're able to just simply push away the auditors by showing the auditors the receipt. Okay, that's one way to explain the machlokas. A second way. Back to the Gemara, Rava Amar, Mochis Gadol, Mochis Katanike Benayhu. Big tax collector, small tax collector. Rashi over here gives a description of what's going on. Pa'amim sheish mochis, I'm reading the Rashi. Pa'amim sheish mochis gadol shetarech lo la'amod al gesher kol hayom, umemana mochis katan. So you have basically a chain of command amongst the tax collectors. You have the person who is the supervisory role, and you have his underlings. And what you did over here is you showed it to the supervising tax collector, the person on the top of the food chain. And now the question becomes the following. So you have a number of the underlings who are coming over to you and asking you if you paid your taxes. So according to the Tanna Kamma, look, you showed it already to the top tax collector. That's the Moches Gadol. And now anyone comes over to you, anyone who's under him, so you just simply say, look, I already paid my taxes, let's go. This answer, by the way, seems very similar to the previous answer. Previous answer, we were talking about the tax collector and auditors. Here we're talking about just simply the chain of command within the tax collectors. And according to Rav Yehuda over here, it's just easier for you to hold on to your receipt, and so therefore, even when the Moches Katan comes and asks you, did you pay your taxes, you'll just simply say yes. And that is how Rashi describes over here the second answer, that of Rava. The Gemara here gives a third answer. Rav Ashi Amar, Chad Moches Ika Benau, Mimei Shetzarech Lo Laharis Lo Moches Sheni, Da Amalei Chazik Avar De Moches Ana. Rav Ashi's answer over here is a little bit of a departure of the first two answers, and that is as follows. According to Rav Ashi, look, you paid the toll. You were given a receipt. You showed the receipt to the tax collector. Okay, good. From this point going forward, you're done. You are cleared. You can now cross the bridge anytime you want. You are now you're good to go. And so, as far as holding on to this receipt, vis-a-vis going over the bridge, there's simply no need to do so. You're fine. However, so and according to the Tanna Kamma, you are now for you this piece of paper is officially worthless. And as a result of that, carrying it after you showed it to the tax collector is not going to incur any liability because the piece of paper now is worthless, it's useless. However, according to Rav Yehuda, there's still a point in having that receipt, and that would be the following. Because even though he agrees with the Tanna Kamma vis-a-vis going over the bridge, you don't need the receipt anymore. There's only one tax collector, and you showed it to him, and all is good. However, the next time you are confronted with another tax collector or another toll, and they're a little bit suspicious about, did you pay taxes, did you not pay taxes? So what you'll do is you'll simply go out to your and you'll show them the receipt from your first experience of paying taxes. And you'll say, look, I'm a good guy. I pay my taxes. Here are receipts from taxes that I already paid. And so what you can do is hold on to these receipts because they will validate and verify that you are, in fact, a honest person and you are, in fact, somebody who pays the taxes. And so for Rav Yehuda, in that regard, this document is still going to have some value as it's going to be able to support and elevate your reputation. And so therefore, according to Rav Yehuda, there still is a value in holding on to it. That is the third answer of the Gemara. That's Rav Ashi's answer. Tanu Rabbanan, the Gemara now continues with a similar discussion, but now we're going to be talking about lender and borrower. Okay, before we have the start of the upcoming Gemara, just some basics regarding lending, borrowing, and the document that's written. Lender lends money to a borrower, so a document is going to be written. The document is, in the Gemara, described as a shtar chov. The way the transaction works is as follows, is that the borrower goes to the lender, borrower says, I need to borrow money. Lender says, great, let's write up a document, just a simple note, IOU. The document is going to be signed by two kosher witnesses. They're going to be seeing the exchange between the borrower and the lender. Lender is going to give the borrower money, and the borrower is going to give the lender the note. That note now that is being held by the lender is obviously going to be the way the lender is going to get paid back with the loan, because it will be proof that he actually loaned the money. And so the note bearer, the holder of the note, is obviously going to be in a position where that note for him is going to be incredibly important in terms of collecting his loan. In terms of the conclusion of the loan, so what's going to happen is that the borrower is going to pay back the lender the money. The lender is then going to hand over the note to the borrower. And what the borrower should do is tear the note into as many pieces as possible, destroy the note. Good, straightforward. That is the transaction of lending in terms of how the note is being used. With that stated, we have the following braisa talking about carrying a note on Shabbos. Hamotzi sharchov. So let's say you're carrying the note on Shabbos, hashlo paruchayev. If the note has not yet been paid, so then for the lender, this note is valuable. What value? The value of whatever the loan is, meaning it's with this note that he's going to be able to collect his loan. And so therefore, carrying it on Shabbos would incur a liability because it's chashuv. Misha paro, however, once the loan has already been paid, pater, so then he's going to be exempt because after the loan has already been paid, it's going to be worthless. Now, this needs a lot of clarification, which is what we're going to be doing over the next number of minutes together. Worthless to the lender, worthless to the borrower, worthless to both. So hold, because we are going to try to clarify that. And Rabbi Yehuda says that no, even after the loan has been paid, you're still going to be chai for carrying the note because the note is still significant to him. Now, him is a pronoun, and so therefore that lends to, Thank you for the pun today. It lends to ambiguity because we don't know which him we're describing over here. We're talking about the lender. We're talking about the borrower. Okay. So we have our work cut out for us because what we have over here clearly is a debate between the Tanakhama and Rav Yehuda vis-a-vis what would happen if one would carry a note outside on Shabbos. Would one violate the malacha of Hotzah? Mind you, by the way, the note, of course, is muksa on Shabbos. It'd be like currency. It's muksa on Shabbos. The discussion over here is not revolving around muksa. That's an issur d'rabbanan. So from that standpoint, one, of course, is not allowed to pick up the note and carry it anywhere. The question over here is liability vis-a-vis Shabbos. Would one violate the malacha voksa on Shabbos? So over here now, if I take a note and carry it outside after the loan's been paid, so before the loan's been paid, we all understand that it is chashav, and therefore is considered carrying on Shabbos. And one would incur the liability of hotzah, chiyuv chatas of hotzah. The question now becomes, the debate is, after the loan's been paid up, is the note going to have any value to whatsoever? Tanakhama says no, Rav Yehuda says yes. And so we have our work cut out for us. What exactly is the debate between the Tanakhama and Rav Yehuda? And here the Gemara is going to give four different explanations of how to understand this debate. Now what I'll do is I'll just simply organize the four upcoming approaches. Approaches 1, 2, and 3 is all assuming that we're talking about the lender carrying the note. And the reason why it would be significant after the payment's already been made is going to be subject to three different explanations. But those are the first three answers. The fourth answer, which we're going to see, is going to assume that the person carrying the note is going to be the borrower even after it's been paid. Okay, so that's just going to be, in terms of organization, the differences between answers 1, 2, 3 versus answer number 4. Let's begin the four answers. Answer number 1. I'm Rav Yosef Vassal HaShoshtar Paroik Abenahu. The question is as follows. After the note's been paid, is there an iser to hold a note after the note's been paid? And this is subject to a debate, says Rav Yosef. And this is really at the core of the debate between the Tanakhama and Rav Yehuda. And he goes on to explain. Rabbanan Savri also lasho shtar the Chachamim of the opinion that it is prohibited to hold onto a note after it's been paid. Now the reason why is both intuitive, and Rashi also cites the pasuk as well. Rashi cites the pasuk al tishkan ba'olach avla, that don't leave in your tent something which is an avla, something which is a sin. Meaning what happens is that after the note's been paid and the lender did not forfeit the note, which he should have done. So what could end up happening is that the lender at a later point in time, illegally, unscrupulously, will go ahead and to try to collect again using this note. Now, even though it's been paid, but if he's still holding on to the note, it could entice him. The greed can get to him, and he'll try to collect it again. So, according to the Tanakhama, it is usur, it is prohibited to go ahead and to hold on to the note after it's been paid. And so based on this iser, so vis-a-vis the chashivas of the note, is the note now going to be considered significant? Just the opposite. Not only is it not significant, it's usur. He shouldn't be maintaining it. So after the note's been paid, by virtue of the fact that the Chachamim banned the holding of the note after it's been paid, so therefore its value is valueless. And so therefore, if you carry it outside in Shabbos, you're going to be pater. And Rabbi Yehuda is of the opinion that it is permissible to hold on to a note after it's been paid. Now this position, Rabbi Yehuda, that it's mutter, so it's hard for me to imagine that he would endorse it and he would condone it, but at the same time, however, he does not label it as being usher after it's paid, and so therefore, according to Rabbi Yehuda, one would be liable, the lender would be liable if it were carried out on Shabbos, even after it's been paid. That is one way to explain the machlokas, whether or not there exists an isser or there does not exist an isser. According to the Tanna Kamma, there does, therefore the note is valueless, post-payment, and according to Rabbi Yehuda, there is no isser, and therefore the note still has a value to it, or has a chashivas to it. Answer number two, Abaye Amar Dukule Amar Salashor Shtar Perua. Abaye says, no, let's just start off with the assumption that everyone agrees that post-payment, it would be prohibited for the lender to hold on to the note. And over here, the issue becomes the following. And over here, the issue is the following. Now, in order to understand this approach of Abaye, so we need a refresher regarding Kiyum Hashtar, authentication of a document. Now, in a document, as I described in the beginning, when a document is signed by two witnesses, the document now is enforced. The Shtar Chov is loaded. And that means to say that min ha-Torah now, the lender can go ahead and collect based on the signature of the two witnesses on the bottom of the document, noting that the loan actually has transpired. However, the Chachamim wanted to put in a certain safeguard in order to make sure that the document is not a forged piece of paper, but rather it's good. And so what they required is authentication. What is the process of authentication? Kiyum Hashtar. This takes us back to the Gemara in Ksuvos. The Gemara in Ksuvos goes over authentication can be done in one of three ways. One, you have the original signers of the document come to Beis Din and say, it is us who signed on the document. So they are testifying that they actually signed on the document. What's going to happen now, they do this in a Beis Din. Beis Din is now going to be writing what's called a henpek, a certification on the bottom of the document saying that the signatures over here are certified. The witnesses themselves came and ratified that they signed the document. That's one. Another way to do it is having another set of witnesses come who say, we recognize the signatures of these two people, and yes, this is the signature of those two people. Everyone signs with a certain certain personal touch, and everyone's signature, somewhat like their fingerprint, is going to be unique to that person. And so and yes, of course, it's possible to forge other people's signature, but again, this is just another level of security. It's not a foolproof level of security. And when you have two other witnesses come and say, look, we recognize the signatures of those people, and that's a match, so this also now is going to be serving as a way of certifying. Again, same thing. It's going to be done in Beis Din. Beis Din is going to accept the testimony of these other two witnesses and certify the document that, in fact, it was authenticated. A third way to do it, says the Gemara Ksuvos, is by having another document with the same signatures that was already certified, side-by-side comparison of the already certified document with this document. If it's a match, Beis Din will go ahead and certify this document as well. Anyway, this is what's called Kiyum Hashtar. The question becomes the following. Let's say lender and borrower go to the court, the document is not certified, and the borrower says, by the way, I'm not disputing the document at all, meaning the document is in fact good, meaning I did in fact borrow the money. So once the borrower goes ahead and admits to the loan, is there a need for certification? The Gemara says this is Abaye's answer. This is going to be the subject of the debate between the Tanna Kamma and Rav Yehuda. And let's see it inside. The question over here is, everyone agrees that you're not allowed to hold on to a shtar perua. V'hachan over here, b'mod b'shtar shekasr shetzarach l'kamo kamiflgi. Let's say the borrower agrees that the loan transpired. And the question now becomes, on top of that, is there still going to need a process of certification? The question essentially is that once the Chachamim demanded a document be certified, does it need to be certified under all circumstances, even in the case where seemingly there's no need to do so, because the borrower is not even disputing it. Tanakama sever mod b'shasha katzur tzarich l'kaimo. According to the Tanakama, even after the Lova admits that the document was in fact written, there still is a requirement to certify the document. And Rav Yehuda sever mod b'shasha katzur ain't tzarich l'kaimo. And according to Rav Yehuda, there is no need to certify the document. And so, this is going to be the debate between the Tanakama and Rav Yehuda. The Tanakama is of the opinion that we are going to need certification even after the borrower says that, yes, in fact, it is correct. So that means to say that in the event that no certification can occur for whatever reason, so the document now to the lender is going to be a worthless document, assuming he can't certify it, even though the borrower is saying it's good. Whereas according to Rav Yehuda, once the borrower goes ahead and admits that this document actually occurred, so now there is no need to certify the document, and therefore the document is going to have value. That is the debate as understood by Abaye. Now, all this is wonderful, but it doesn't really fit into the words of the Braisa. You go back to the Braisa, you're trying to read this into the Braisa. The Braisa is talking about before payment and post payment. Over here, the way Abaye is explaining it, it has nothing to do with payment. Payment didn't occur. It's just a question of there is no certification, but the borrower is acknowledging that the loan actually transpired. So do I need certification? It doesn't fit into the words of the Braisa at all. And the Gemara is going to note that right now. So the Gemara says we're on the very bottom of Ein Chesem and Beis. Umai, ad shelo paru umisha paru. Now the wording of the Braisa. Ad shelo paru before he paid, misha paru from when he paid. That's not really the way Abai is describing it. And so, ad shiyomer lova parati, velo parati. So what we're going to do is, either the Gemara is suggesting a full edit of the Braisa, or just a reinterpretation of the Braisa. Either way, the Braisa should be understood as, the lova said, and either it was paid, or the lova said it was not paid. Meaning the lova is admitting to the loan. That is a second way to explain the Braisa. Here we are now with the third way of explaining the Braisa. Rava Amar Dekulei Amam with the B'Shar Shekasur Shetzarach L'Kaimo. Rava says, no, everyone's going to be in agreement that even if the borrower is admitting to the loan, the assumption over here is that you're going to still have to certify and authenticate the document. And V'Hacha, but over here the question becomes the following. Kosrin Shover Kamiflagi. The question over here is whether or not a receipt can be written. Now, like I said in the beginning of our entire discussion, typically, traditionally, the way that the loan came to a conclusion is that the borrower would pay back the money, the lender would hand the note over to the borrower, the borrower should destroy it immediately, and that's the conclusion. However, let's say the following. Let's say we have a situation in which a lender goes over to the borrower and says, look, it's time to pay. Borrower says, fine, let's certify the document. They did certify the document. Document's been ratified, certified by a Beis Din. And now, borrower says to lender, okay, here's the money. Now go ahead and give me the document. And after it's been certified, the lender says, oh, look, I'm really sorry. I don't know where the document is. And the borrower says, oh, that's funny. I'm not going to pay you back until you actually show me the document. Not only show me the document, give me the document. And now the question becomes the following. We saw this at the end of Masechta Baba Basra. The Gemara discusses this in more detail. Here we're touching on the issue, and that is, does the lender now have an option to say to the borrower, look, you and I already ratified the document. We certified the document. You know you owe me the money, right? That's not the issue. The issue is right now is that I misplaced the document. So can we do the following? You'll pay me back you'll pay me back the loan money, and we'll just simply write you a receipt. And can the lender demand that the borrower pay back the loan and accept the receipt? And so if in the event that there ever comes a time in the future where the lender decides to pull out the loan document in order to collect the loan, so the borrower will be protected by the fact that he now has a receipt. Now, there are two positions in the Gemara Baba Basra, which the Gemara over here is citing. One is Ein Kosvin Shover. No, we can't do this. We can't basically put the onus on the borrower that in order for him now to protect himself, he's going to have to hold on the receipt forever. Look, he paid back his loan. The only way that he's going to have to pay back his loan is only if the original loan document can be handed over to him, in which he can destroy it. Otherwise, he doesn't have to pay back the loan. That's ain kosrin shover. On the other hand, the other position is kosrin shover, that we will, in fact, tell the borrower to pay back the loan. Right now, the loan document is temporarily misplaced. So you know what? When I find it, I'll give it to you. In the meanwhile, here, hold on to this receipt. We're going to write you a receipt, and you're going to hold on to the receipt. And this is a major debate in the Gemara over there at the end of Baba Basra. And the Gemara says over here, this is another way to explain our machlokes. Tanakama Savar, Kosrin Shover. Tanakama is of the opinion that you could write a Shover. And so therefore, it is possible, it's feasible, that the loan document vis-a-vis the lender is in his possession after the payment of the loan, and it's still going to be, after the payment of the loan, but it's not going to be significant because a receipt was written to the borrower. And so the borrower is always going to be in a position where even if the loan document is found at a later point in time, the borrower is basically going to be able to rebuff because he has a shofar, he has a receipt. And so therefore, according to the Tanna Kamma, post-payment, the loan document is rendered worthless, and therefore carrying on Shabbos is going to be potter. Whereas according to Rabbi Yehuda, suffering kosher and shofar, Rabbi Yehuda is of the opinion that you don't write a shofar, and so therefore the loan document is going to be significant even post-payment. And the lender is not going to get paid until he finds a loan document. And so therefore, for him, that loan document is going to be significant all the time. And therefore, if he carries it on Shabbos, he's going to be chayv. That's going to be a third way to explain the machlokas. And finally, we get to a fourth way of explaining the machlokas. Admittedly, this is going to be, by the way, the longest section of today's daf, just in terms of the fact that there is so much explanation that's necessary just to get to a simple pshat between the Tanakam and Rabbi Yehuda. And now we're up to our fourth explanation over here, and that's Ravashi. Ravashi Amar. And now Ravashi over here makes a major shift, and that is that we're no longer talking about the lender carrying the loan document. We're now talking about the borrower. The borrower now paid off his loan, received the loan document. Now, again, like I mentioned already a number of times, he should destroy it at this point in time. There's no point in him maintaining the loan document. And so therefore, according to the Tanna Kamma, when the borrower takes this loan document, which has already been paid, so what's its value? The Tanna Kamma says its value is zero. In fact, like I said, it should actually be destroyed. But in terms of what its current value is, it doesn't have any value. And so therefore, the borrower who carries it outside on Shabbos is going to be potter. What would be Rav Yehuda's position? So this is now Rav Ashi explaining. Rav Ashi Amar Mimnei Shetzarach La'aros L'Abal Chosheni D'Amalei Chazik Avar D'Para Anai. So over here we're talking about how does a person bolster his own credit score. So nowadays we have these national services that tell the world what our credit score is. Back in the good old days, so how would a person bolster his own credit and his own credit score? So basically what he would do is he would go over to a potential lender and he would say to him, look, I need a loan. And by the way, I'm the kind of guy who pays. Here's an old loan document of mine where I took out a loan and I paid the loan. And here's proof that I paid a loan previously. And so please lend me the money because I'm the kind of guy who pays. So according to Rav Ashi, this is going to be the debate between the Tanna Kamma and Rav Yehuda. Tanna Kamma says that the document vis-a-vis the borrower is worthless. And Rabbi Yehuda says, not really, because it could have value in that it could be proof positive and a bolstering of his credit score that he has in fact paid loans historically, and so therefore it would incentivize another lender to go ahead and lend the money in the future. And so, ending our first section, our first topic today in the Gemara, two types of documents that are being carried on Shabbos, a debate between the Tanakam and Rav Yehuda in terms of whether or not a person would be chai for carrying it. The first document that we're talking about is the toll collector's receipt. You paid your toll, you got a receipt, you carried it on Shabbos, are you going to be chayiv? So after you showed it already to the toll collector, so according to the Tanakam, you're going to be pater, it has no value, and Rav Yehuda says, no, it is going to be chayiv, and there we gave three different explanations of how to understand the debate between the Tanna Kamma and Rabbi Yehuda. On a second issue, another note that's being carried on Shabbos is going to be a standard note, an IOU, that was written from the borrower to the lender because the borrower borrowed money. And then, post-payment, it's being carried out into the Rishus HaRabim. Is one going to be chai for carrying it post-payment? A debate between the Tanakhama and Rabbi Yehuda. Tanakhama says no. Why? Because it has zero value, and so therefore it's no longer a davar chashuv, and therefore one would not be liable. And according to Rabbi Yehuda, one would still be liable even after its post-payment. That debate requires an explanation, and the Gemara gave four different ways to explain it. I'm not going to review all four different ways because, as you saw, it took a significant amount of time to go through each one of them in detail, but four different ways to explain it. The difference between the first three versus the last one is that the first three we're assuming it is the lender who took it out to the Rishus HaRabim, and the debate between the Tanakhama and Rabbi Yehuda is, to the lender, can it have any significance? Tanakhama says no, Rabbi Yehuda says yes, predicated on the three different explanations of why. And the fourth explanation, that of Ravashi, is that it is the borrower who took it out into the Rishus HaRabim after the payment's been made. According to the Tanakhama, it has no value. And according to Rabbi Yehuda, it still has a value because it can improve its credit score. Mm-hmm. Ad Khan, that takes us to the first sugya. And now we continue in the Gemara. We're on Ayin Tesamad Aleph and Od Or Kedei Lasos. We move on to the Shir when it comes to a hide. When it comes to a hide, so we're talking about a hide that is... the entire hide, meaning it has both the outer and the inner sides to it. I'll explain what that means a little bit better in just a moment. The Mishnah says it is the amount to make a kameah an amulet. By minei rava, mei rav napan. The following question was asked. Hamotzi or bekama. How much would one be chayv if one were to carry out a hide on Shabbos? Amalei kedinah. He says, what kind of question is that? That's the Mishnah. Or kedei lasos kameah. The Mishnah says, hide, the amount to make a amulet. Hamavdo bekama. So he says, what if the hide was processed? So Amalei lo shna, it's the same thing. Meaning, a processed hide is going to be the amount of making an amulet. Li avdo bekama. He says, well, let's say the hide isn't processed yet. So it is unprocessed hide. Amalei lo shna, he says, it doesn't make a difference. Whether the hide is processed or whether it's unprocessed, the shear is going to be the amount to make an amulet. Omanat temra kedinan. He says, look, let me show you a Mishnah. The Mishnah comes up later in the Masechta. Hamelabein. We're talking about treating the wall and whitening the wool, hamenafetz, combing the wool, sovea, dyeing the wool, vatova, spinning the wool, shiuro, what is the shear, how much of it would one be chayev? Kamala ruch of a sitka full, it would be the width of sitka full. If you take your two fingers, your index and your middle finger, and you separate them, the distance between them, so that is what's called in halacha a sit. You take that and you double it, so that's what's called sit kaful. So if you are going to be doing a process, these are all malachas that we already discussed back in Ayin Gimel. If you do the process of either libun, menafit, sovea, tove, to the thread that is this size, so one is going to be chay. Veha oreg, bezchutim, shiur, kamale rochav asit. Now if you're weaving two strings, so the shear over there is going to be one distance between the two fingers as they are separated. Now, Alma, Kema de Litve Kai, Shira Kitavui. Now, you haven't spun the thread yet, but still, because you plan on spinning the thread, so therefore the shear is going to be the same for shear, for thread unspun, but you plan on spinning it, just as it would be for thread that was already spun. Hachanami Kema de Lavdo Kai, Shira Kima Uvad. So the same thing is true over here. When you have hide and you plan on processing the hide, so the shear is going to be the same as hide that's already processed. Ushalola abda bekama. Okay, fine. So now that we have all that clarified, let's say you have the hide of an animal with no plans to process it whatsoever. It's going to be kept in its unprocessed state. What would be the shear? Amalei lo shna. He says, again, it's not going to make a difference. It would be the amount to make an amulet. So the Gemara says, v'lo shani bein mu'uba l'shena mu'uba. Now here, he says, I have a difficulty with this last answer. Meaning, if I have hide that we plan on processing, fine. I'm ready to accept the fact that if you plan on processing it, it will have the same shear as hide that you actually processed. But if we're talking about, if we're putting a side-by-side comparison of hide that is processed and hide that is unprocessed, and you're telling me now that it's not going to make a difference and the shear is going to be the same, on that I'm going to have difficulty. And he says, and not only difficulty three times over. So let's start off with round number one. There are three rounds now. We're going to see clearly there's a difference between processed and unprocessed. Eishvei, we start off with the first Amotzi Simonim. shruyim kedei litzvah bem dugma le'ira. If let's say you carry simanim on Shabbos, simanim the herbs, roots that are going to be used for dyeing. So how much of it, these dyes, would one be chayv if carrying on Shabbos? So enough in order to dye a sample. Now, let's say the dyes have not been soaking yet. So we're talking about dyes, but unprocessed. So tanan, so that is a Mishnah also that we're going to be seeing later on. So these are all different types of fruits that are going to be used for dyes, but they're all unprocessed. We haven't soaked them yet. So the amount that you need in order to be chayv on Shabbos, a chash of shear is going to be the amount to dye a small garment. The svacha, that was the head covering that we discussed back in the sixth parak of our Masechta. So, when you have processed dye, how much do you need? Only enough to, you only need enough for a sample, which is a small shear. But if it's unprocessed, so then how much is considered a davar chashuv? So it's going to be the amount where you're going to end up dyeing an entire garment. Small one, but an entire garment. So you see that there's a difference between processed and unprocessed. So the Gemara says, "Ha itmar lamar Rav Nachman Amar Rav Baravul Afishin Adam Tareach L'Shor Simanim Litzvah Ben Dugma Le'ira." So the Gemara says, "Okay, that's true, but I'll tell you why there's a difference. Because if we're dealing with the original fruits that are going to be used for dyes, so that means to say that we have to process them. We have to go ahead and go through the process of soaking them, cooking them in water in order to extract the color. That process is labor intensive. It costs money." A person is not going to do it until he's going to be making a significant amount of dye. So that's why for the fruits that are going to be used for dyeing, it has to be a greater amount. Because nobody's going to go through the trouble of making a dye just to go ahead and to dye one particular sample of cloth. Once you have the processed dye, so then what's going to be significant? Well, people dye samples. And so therefore, once it's processed, so then the shear is going to be a smaller shear because now you don't have to go through the trouble of making it. Okay, that's the difference between dyes, processed versus unprocessed. Round number two. Now, what about seeds that go into the garden? Now, before you plant the seeds, how much? So how many seeds is considered chashuv? So it happens to be a machlokas in the Mishnah, which we're also going to be seeing later together. Mishnah is going to be a couple weeks from now. But anyway, the Mishnah later on talks about either amount of seeds less than a grogeris, or it's going to be five seeds. Anyway, the ilubasa de zarino. Now, after you planted the seeds in the ground, tanan, zevel v'chol hadak kedela zavel bo kelach shel kruv, the Rebbe Kiva, v'chachamim amrim kedela zavel krisha. In terms of fertilizer and sand, so how much would one carry? Enough to fertilize kelach shel kruv, one stalk, or according to Rabbi Kiva, or according to the Chachamim, just a krisha, another type of small vegetable. But what you see over here is that once the seed is in the ground, and for our purposes, we're going to call that a processed seed, because we're just going over the idea of processed versus unprocessed, a processed seed, so you see that it really comes out to a much smaller shear. Again, the difference between processed and unprocessed in terms of shearing. So again, the Gemara says, "Hi, Marla." Over here as well, we say the following: "Amar Papa Hadizria Hadalozria Lefishin Adam Tarech Lotzia Nima Achas Lozria." So the Gemara says it's basically going to be the same type of answer. If we're talking about the actual seeds themselves, the unprocessed seed, if you will, so there you're going to go through the trouble of planting one seed. Of course not. In other words, you have to work the ground, you have to till the ground, you have to make the ground ready for planting. It's going to be a process. You're not going to go through the trouble of putting one seed in the ground, preparing a whole parcel of land to put one seed in the ground. So for the unprocessed seed, it's going to be more because of the labor that's involved. Once it's a processed seed, meaning once it's in the ground and it starts taking root, so then in of itself, it's going to be significant. Okay, and we're going to do this now round number three. Now it happens to be that we just saw this in yesterday's daf, so this is good chazara from yesterday. In terms of water, which is used water on Shabbos, right? Water you wash your face with already, whatever. Water that's used, right? This is what's called shofchen. And all you plan on doing is dumping it outside. However, on Shabbos, to carry it from one rishus to another, you're not allowed to do. When is it chashuv? When is it significant? When you have the revius of it. Now, the havina b'ashov chen l'may chaz yamar rav yirmi l'gaba b'emes atit. Now, what good is this wasted water, meaning this used water? And the answer is that it helps you make mortar. So, how much used water do you have to carry on Shabbos in order to be chayiv? A revius. Why? Because it is good to make mortar with it. The ilu basa de gavle. Now, when the mortar is already processed, how much mortar is one going to be chayiv? Tanya, take a day lasos bam pikur. The mouth of the instrument of the goldsmith. That is a small amount. I already admitted yesterday, I don't even know what the instrument looks like. But anyway, the opening, the mouth of it is very small, and all I need is just mortar to fill up the opening, and then you'd be chayiv. A much smaller amount. And so, again, the difference between processed versus unprocessed. And here, again, the answer is going to be the same. It's the same answer. And that if you're making the mortar, so you're only going to go through the effort of making mortar if you're going to be making a significant amount of mortar. You're not going to be putting together just a couple drops of water, a couple drops of the clay in order to make a small amount of mortar. It's going to be a significant amount. But once it's made, so then it's because its usage now could be any amount, as long as it can cover the pikur, so then you're going to be chayv. It's the same answer. Tashma. Okay, so we have now three times over made a distinction between processed and unprocessed, but three times over we pointed out, yeah, but the shear is going to be bigger for unprocessed because it's so much effort to go from unprocessed to process, so therefore you're not going to bother going through the process unless the shear is a bigger shear. Okay, so for three times over we now said it. We go back to the hides because remember the entire discussion started because in the back and forth between Rav and Rav Nachman, Rav Nachman was insistent that hides, it doesn't matter if it's processed or unprocessed, the shear is going to be the same. Tashma, the Gemara, once again, comes back at this with the following. Amar Rabbi Chiya Bar Ami Mishmei De'ula Shlosha Arosein. Now, in terms of hides, there are three stages of hide. Meaning, how many times have I personally been involved in the processing of hide? The answer, as everyone here knows, is zero. I've never been involved in the processing of hide. However, there are basically three levels, three processes. And the Gemara is going to go through the three processes, and each one of them is going to be given its own unique name. They are matzah, chefa, diftera. Matzah, we're going to go through each one. Matzah is when hide is at its most unprocessed state. Kemashma'o. Now, what does it look like? It looks like matzah, meaning we're describing here the hide of an animal. But because it's totally unprocessed, and it looks like matzah, now it's for us to fully understand, do any of us really know what unprocessed hide looks like? I mean, we can all envision. Matzah also back in their day, not matzah in our days. I have a funny feeling, a good feeling that it didn't look exactly the same. Whatever the case is, the unprocessed hide looked like matzah. Therefore, the way they described unprocessed hide was matzah. Delav meliach, it wasn't salted. Lo kamiach, they didn't put flour on it. Delo afitz, there was also gold nuts that was rubbed into it. So in other words, the processing of the hide involves step one, salt, step two, flour, step three, gall nuts. Matzah, meaning the most unprocessed hide, had none of this. The kamashiro, now how much would one have to carry on Shabbos in order to be chayiv? Tini Rav Shmuel bar Rav Yehuda kedilatzu bro mashkolos ketana. Enough to wrap a small weight. The kamar amarabai deriva the pumpadisa, a quarter of a quarter of the weight in pumpadisa. He's referring to some weight that was known in Pumbedisa. Anyway, so you see that for the fully unprocessed hide, the shear is going to be the amount to carry, to cover, wrap around a full weight. Chefa. Now, stage two, or the next level of hide, is what's called chefa. The maliach. It was salted, but that's it. Lo kamiach v'lo afitz. But it didn't go through the step of flour, nor the step of gall nuts. V'kamish yiroki denan, or kadei lasos kameah. That's our Mishnah. That is the amount to make an amulet. And diftera, and now we get to the last stage where it is now fully processed hide. So, the maliach v'kameach v'lo afitz, diftera is salted, it's floured, it didn't go through the process of golnut. So I'm going to just retract a little bit, not fully processed, mostly processed. V'kamish yiron, how much is that? K'dei lichtov alav is a get, that's enough to write a get on it. Okay. But what we see over here is, let's just compare side by side, fully unprocessed, partially unprocessed. Fully unprocessed, that was the matzah stage. So there, the shear is the amount to wrap around a weight. And when it comes to partially processed, So the shear is to make a kamea. And so this seems to knock out Rav Nachman. At the beginning of this entire sugya, Rav Nachman said the shear doesn't make a difference. And over here, clearly, how processed it is going to make a difference in the shear. And the Gemara is just going to spell out the question. And so, how can you tell me that doesn't make a difference when here clearly we learn together it does make a difference, whether it is unprocessed or partially processed? Hasam bibishula. So the Gemara says, well, over here we're talking about where the unprocessed hide was moist. And as Rashi explains over here, because it was moist, so therefore we are not even prepared to process it. Meaning the reason why Rav Nachman said that there's no difference is because unprocessed, you plan on processing it. Over here, because the hide is fresh hide and it's still moist, so therefore we're not even in a position where we could begin to process it, and so therefore the shear is going to be different. The Hatanan, the Gemara here, challenges once again. Ha beged, shlosha shlosha, lemedras, hasak, dala al dala, haor, hey al hey, mafetz vav vav, bein lemedras, bein lemes. And so we go through again the minimum shirim of clothing based on what material it is made out of in order for it to be subject to Tumas Medras, Tumas Mace, Vitzni Allah. I'm not going to go through the numbers right now. We've done this actually pretty recently. But on this, the Braisa, HaBeged V'Asak V'Or Kishir L'Tuma, Kach Shir L'Otza. So as far as clothing, goat's hair, and hides, the shear that we have just expressed vis-a-vis Tuma is going to be the shear for Hotza as well. And what we're seeing together is that when I have hide, the shear of hide is 5 by 5 tefachim, and we just learned together that just like that is the amount to make it significant vis-a-vis Kabbalah Satuma, it's going to be the same shear in terms of carrying on Shabbos. Now, how can that be? Meaning, we just said that when it comes to hides, according to Rav Nachman, the Mishnah taught us this year is going to be kedei kamia, the amount to make an amulet, and Rav Nachman says it doesn't matter if it's processed or unprocessed. So the shear is always going to be the same. And meanwhile, we just learned together, the Braisa said that for hides, it's going to be the shear of Hotzah, it's going to be the same shear as Tuma, which is 5 by 5 tefachim. The Gemara's response, ahu bikur tivla. Over there, we're talking about where the hide was cooked. That's Rashi, the last Rashi in our Amud. It was cooked in boiling water, and it was hardened in order so that you could sit down on it. And so therefore, it is basically processed into a cushion, and therefore, since it's processed into a cushion, the shear is going to be that of a cushion 5x5 tefachim area. Okay. That is a long discussion in the Gemara. Vis-a-vis, is there going to be a difference between processed hide and unprocessed hide in terms of the shear? Rav Nachman says that there's not going to be a difference, and for most of the Amud Aleph of today's daf, the Gemara notes other areas in Halacha where there is a difference between processed and unprocessed, clearly, and the Gemara deflects each one of them, saying that those cases are different, and the Gemara ends up defending Rav Nachman that when it comes to hide, for both processed and unprocessed hide, the shear is going to be kedei kamea. Okay, with the notable exception that what we just learned together is that if the hide itself went through its own type of processing, i.e., it was cooked in boiling water, so then it's going to be then it's going to be limited to use as a cushion, and the shear is going to be a different shear of 5x5 tefachim. Okay, that kind of takes us to the end of the Amud Aleph, and let us now begin the Amud Beis. Ayin Tes Amud Beis. As we are continuing on the top of the Amud, and we move now to the topic of klaf. Klaf kedei lichtav ala parsha katana. How much klaf you carry on Shabbos in order to be chayv? The amount to write the smallest parsha that goes into tefillin. Tefillin has four parshios in it. Each one of the parshios in the Torah that discusses tefillin is written into one of the batim of the tefillin on the shel rosh. There are four separate batim. Each one of the parshios is put into its respective bias, the order. As we all know, machlokus between Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam, what the order of how those parshios go in, and then on the shel yad, all the dal parshios are written on one klaf, and then inserted into the one bais on the shel yad. Okay, crash course in tefillin. Anyway, but here's something that we need to know for the Amud Beis of today's daf, and that is that when you take the hide off of an animal, so that hide now could be separated into two layers, two sheets, so to say. The outer layer is what's called the klaf. In fact, the best way to remember it is klaf is a derivative of the word klipa, klipa meaning the outer shell. So when you take the hide of the animal and you go ahead and separate the hide into two parts, the most outer part is what's called the klaf. The interior part is called the duchsustis. That is definitely not a Hebrew word, probably a word, probably a Greek word. I'm not sure, but anyway, that is the interior skin, the interior hide. And so the question now becomes the following: when writing a tefillin, when writing a mezuzah, when writing a Sefer Torah, should we write, we're writing on a klaf, should we be writing on duchsustis? And that is the Gemara's discussion from here until the end of our daf today. So Uriminu, the Gemara challenges based on the following klaf, duchsustis kedei lift of a lav mezuzah. Now, in the Braisa, it says that klaf and duchsustis. Again, a klaf is the outer portion of the hide. Duchsustis is the interior portion. So it's enough to write a mezuzah. So my mezuzah, mezuzah should be tefillin. Now, the word mezuzah over here could be understood as parchment, meaning the mezuzah, the parsha that goes in the tefillin. The Gemara says, really? The karlul tefillin mezuzah? Is that plausible? That the parchment that goes into tefillin is actually called mezuzah in? The Gemara says, yeah, certainly possible. V'atanya, we have a brisa that certainly would support this idea. And the brisa over here, Ritzuas Tfilin, Im HaTfilin, Mitamas HaSiyadayim, Bifnei Atzman, sorry, Im HaTfilin, Mitamas HaSiyadayim, Bifnei Atzman, Im Mitamas HaSiyadayim. So, according to the Tanakhama, we are speaking here about Tumas HaYadayim. Tumas HaYadayim, when a Sefer Torah touches your hand, it's Mitame Es HaYadayim. This is an idea that we already discussed in the beginning of the Masechta Shabbos. This is part of Yud-Ches Davar, it's part of the 18 Zeros that were enacted by Beis Shammai. Going all the way back to Daf Yadalin here in Shabbos, we discuss this in some detail. Why the Chachamim made it that touching a cloth is going to make your hands, render your hands a Shein L'tuma. So go back to the beginning of the Masechta where we discussed it in some detail. Anyway, what we're discussing over here is that if your hands were to come into contact with, let's say, the tefillin, are your hands going to be subject to Tumas Yadayim? So according to the Tanakhama of this Braisa, when the ritzuos, the straps of the tefillin, are together with the tefillin, tied with the tefillin, so the straps themselves are going to be Metamas Yadayim. However, if the straps are independent of the tefillin, if they're not tied into the tefillin, they're not Metamas Yadayim. Rabbi Shimon ben Yehuda, Rabbi Shimon HaNogeh, Ritzuo, Tahor, Ashiga, Bekitsitsa. If you touch just the straps, your hands are not subject to Tumas Yadayim, until you touch the actual box itself of the tefillin. And Rabbi Zakkai Mishmo Omer Tahor Ashigah B'Mizuzah Atzmo. And Rabbi Zakkai says that a person is not going to be, his hands are not going to be a Shein L'Tumah until you touch the parchment. What's the word that's used in this braisa to describe parchment? Mezuzah. Mezuzah over here, it's spoken about in the context of tefillin, so presumably we're talking about the klaf of the tefillin. And so what we see over here clearly is that klaf could be described as mezuzah. Now the Gemara says, now wait one second. You're not sharing with us the entire brisa. Let's take a look at the entire brisa. At the end of that very brisa, it describes the parchment that goes into tefillin, and it calls it the klaf. So that means that the first part of the brisa is talking about the actual mezuzah. So hachi ketani. So the Gemara says, okay. So here is how we're going to understand the brisa. Klaf. V'duchsustus, shi'ur and bekama. So the Bryce over here is describing the shear for both klaf and for duchsustus. So duchsustus, k'dei lichtav alav mezuzah, duchsustus, which is the part of the hide in which mezuzah should be written on. So that's going to be the shear of how much you carry on Shabbos in order to be chayiv. So it's going to be mezuzah. And klaf, k'dei lichtav alav parsha ketana shebet tefillin. And when it comes to klaf, the amount that's going to be significant is going to be that which you write tefillin. Shema Yisrael, which is in fact Shema Yisrael. Okay, so we are now somewhat at peace with when our Mishnah over here is describing klaf. It's describing that which goes that which is written for the tefillin, because tefillin is written on klaf. And when it comes to mezuzah, so the mezuzah is written on the duchsustus, on the interior portion of the hide. Good. And the way we just clarified the braisa now fits into the words of the Mishnah. With all that stated now, so we have it that tefillin is written on klaf, mezuzah is written on duchsustus, And the question that we're going to be dealing with for the remainder of the daf is, can they be flipped? Amar Rav, duchsustus harei kaklaf. Ma klaf kosman alav tfilin, av duchsustus kosman alav tfilin. I'm going to reread that again because I would like to put in the punctuation a little bit clearer. Amar Rav, duchsustus harei kaklaf. Let's put a period over there. So Rav makes the following statement, which is duchsustus and klaf are the same. He does not mean physically, meaning he understands, like we do, that klaf is the exterior and duchsustus is the interior. What he's saying is that there is halachic validity to both of them in that you can do the same to the both of them. The same what? That part's not clear. Meaning we just put a period over here so that we know that what Rav is saying is that they're sharing a halacha. What halacha do they share? So at this point in time, we're not totally sure. What the Gemara now is going to do is make a suggestion, and what the Gemara is going to try to do for the remainder of this Amud is see whether or not this suggestion is defensible. And the suggestion of the Gemara is, Maklaf kosan alav tefillin, abdususus kosan alav tefillin. Well, we all know that you write the tefillin on the cloth, and what Rav is suggesting is that just like you can write tefillin on cloth, you can also write tefillin on duchsustus as well. That's what we think Rav is saying. And what the Gemara now is going to do is challenge, because this position is not going to withstand the barrage of braises that we're going to learn together. Let's start. Tanan, we start with the Mishnah, Klaf Kedei Lichta, Parsha Katana Shevet Tefillin, Shishma Yisrael. And you can read the parentheses over here, Rashi has them, Klaf in duchsustus lo. And so what our Mishnah is teaching us is, how much klaf do you have to carry on Shabbos in order to be chayev? The amount to write a parsha in tefillin. It certainly sounds like that the only viable part of the high that you could write tefillin is only on the klaf and not on the duchsustus. And this goes against our understanding of Rav. The Gemara attempts to deflect lemitzvah. What the Mishnah means is that primarily the tefillin should be written on klaf, but b'diavad it could be written on duchsustus. Tashma, the Gemara once again tries to prove. Halach l'moshe misinai tefillin on klaf, v'mezuzah al duchsustus. We have the following halach l'moshe misinai. That tefillin should be written on klaf, and mezuzah should be written on duchsustus. Klaf b'makom basar, duchsustus b'makom seyar. Klaf should be written on the interior on the klaf, and duchsustus should be written on the exterior on the duchsustus. The best way for me to explain this, to articulate this, is as follows. Just for a moment, imagine now taking the hide off the animal, and now what we're going to do is we're going to do a separation. We're going to peel the klaf away from the duchsustus. So that now interior area where we're just peeling, so for the tefillin, that is going to be on the klaf side. That's where you're going to be writing the klaf. That's where you're going to be writing on the klaf. And on the duchsustus side, that's where you're going to be writing on the duchsustus to the mezuzah. So that meaning on the part that you're peeling away one from the other, so it's on that area where you're writing tefillin for klaf and mezuzah for duchsustus. Good. And but what comes out over here, again, with pretty good clarity, is that the tefillin is only written on the klaf, and the mezuzah is only written on the duchsustus. And again, the Gemara deflects over here, lemitzvah. What we could say is, yeah, that's primarily, ideally. But b'di'evin, you could write the tefillin on the duchsustus. At that time, the Gemara quotes another b'risa, shina pasul. The b'risa says that if you deviate, it's going to be disqualified. So a mezuzah. So the Gemara again deflects. The Gemara says maybe that's just talking about the mezuzah. V'hatan yeshina b'zeh b'zeh pasul. We have another b'risa that says that deviation in both directions is going to be pasul. And again, the simplest way to read that is that the tefillin has to be written on the klaf, and if I write in duchsustus, it's no good. Mezuzah has to be written on duchsustus, and if it's written on klaf, it's no good. So ed v'ed mezuzah. And again, the Gemara deflects. The Gemara says no. The way to understand that b'risa is talking about the mezuzah. V'had dekasvinu a klaf. And deviation over here meaning I wrote it on the wrong side. On the klaf, as we just learned together, you have to write it on the interior side of the klaf, the side that faces the interior of the body. On the duchsustus, you must write it on the exterior on the duchsustus, the part that faces the outside of the body. And when it says shina bazeh bazeh, it means I wrote it on the wrong side. That is a way to understand the b'risa. Again, just a way of defending our pshat within Rav. Or the Gemara says, what we could say is, look, let's read the b'risa kipshuto. That tefillin has to be written on klaf. And mezuzah has to be written on duchsustus. And it could very well be, in terms of defending Rav, so we could just simply say that it is a machlokes ha-tanayim. It's funny, by the way, I'm saying this now somewhat parenthetically, The Gemara could also say that Rav has the status of a Tana, and Rav can argue with a Tana, but what the Gemara now, that answer is usually reserved for when we have nothing else to say. But over here, the Gemara now has a Braisa. The Tanya we learned in the Braisa, Shina Bezeb Bezeb Hustle. So here in the Braisa, Tanakama says that deviation, meaning if I wrote Tefillin on Tosustos, or if I wrote Mezuzah on Klav, it's no good, period. However, that's the Tanakama. Rabbi Acha, Machshir, Mishum Rabbi Acha Barchanina, Va'amrila, Mishum Rabbi Yaakov Barchanina. And Rabbi Acha, now he said it in whose name, subject to a question of Girsa, but Rabbi Acha is of the opinion that if you deviate, it's not possible. And so therefore we can have Rav aligned with this position of Rav Acha. Rav Papa Amar Rav Damar Ketana Debe Menashe. Rav Papa also offers another defense of Rav, and that is that Rav is holding like Tana Debe Menashe. The Tana Debe Menashe, Kasva Alanir Ve'alamatlas Psula, if I write it, now that's a pronoun, right? We get into this a lot when dealing with pronouns, we don't know what it's modifying. But kasva, if I write it on niyar, in a matlis, on paper, so it's going to be pasul, al klaf, al gvil, al duchsusis kshera. But if I write it on klaf and vil and duchsusis, so it's going to be kasher. Now kasva mai, what it are we talking about? What are we writing on it? Ilem and mezuzah, mezuzah, klaf, mi kasvinan. Now the Gemara says, mezuzah, you don't write mezuzah on klaf. Now, the funny part, by the way, is parenthetically, we do, but We'll come back to that later in at the end of the summit. So elalav tefillin. So the Gemara says, so what we're talking about over here is tefillin. Letamer. So So if this is correct, so now we have this Tanda Bei Menashe supporting the position of Rav, where that is, I could write tefillin on klaf. I could write on dechsustos, just like the way we originally understood Rav. Letamer tefillin akvil mikasvin. The Gemara says, wait 1 second. In this Tanda Bei Menashe you just quoted, it said you could write it on klaf, on duchsustus, and on gvil. Now gvil is fully processed hide, but it's not separated, and you could write on gvil. So and the Gemara says, but everyone agrees you can't do that. Ella kitanya hi b'sefer Torah. So the Gemara says that no, this price over here was not talking about tefillin, but rather was talking about sefer Torah. And lema misayeya le. The Gemara now is suggesting that maybe we have a brisa that would support Rav. Kayotibo, tefillin shabala, v'sefer Torah shabala. Let's say you have tefillin that was worn out, or sefer Torah that was worn down. Ein osim a mezuzah. So one cannot make a mezuzah from these tefillin. Meaning, basically, the idea is you want to recycle. So look, the sefer Torah worn down, the tefillin worn down. But what we could do is we could salvage, cut out the partios and put them and make a mezuzah out of them. And the reason why you can't do that is because that is a downgrade in kedusha and malin v'kodesh. You go up in kedusha v'ein maridim, but you don't go down in kedusha. And going from a sefer Torah or from tefillin down to mezuzah is a reduction of kedusha. So and the Gemara points out time day maridim. Now this is the only thing that is the impediment. Ha maridim, but if that weren't the issue, osin. Now, otherwise, you could do it. And so, therefore, what we are suggesting over here is that you can transfer you can recycle old tefillin into mezuzah. Now, what kind of parchment was it written on? Dixiva amai. Lav dixiva duchsustus. The Gemara says, now, look, it was written on duchsustus. And the whole point over here is that when written on duchsustus, you could use duchsustus for both tefillin and for mezuzah. And again, this would all support Rav if our original understanding is correct. So the Gemara says, "Lo diksiva klaf." The Gemara says, "No, it was written on klaf." And mezuzah klaf mikasvina. The Gemara says, "Are you allowed to write mezuzah on klaf?" The Gemara says, "In, yes, you are." The Hatayin. The Gemara quotes the Brisa, "Kasva al klaf al nir v'al matlas psula." So, if you write it on klaf on nir on matlas, it's going to be pasul. I'm Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar. Rabbi Meir, "Hayakosa al klaf." Rabbi Meir, who by the way throughout Shas is known as like the sofer. Rabbi Meir, when he wrote his mezuzah, he wrote on klaf. Why? In our Gemara, we have the word mipi. It should probably be mipnei. Mipnei shemishtameres, because klaf lasts a lot longer. And so therefore, when you're writing your mezuzah, you want it to last for a long time, so it's better to write on klaf. Okay, so what we just got out from all this discussion is that this idea that you could be writing a tefillin duchsustus, it was our original understanding of Rav, but it's fraught with difficulty. We quoted Mishnayos, Braisos, that certainly seem to suggest that you can't do it. And although the Gemara defended the position of Rav, but it's really difficult. The Gemara also cited Braisos that may support Rav, but the Gemara pointed out, but not necessarily. And when all said and done, we are basically a little bit stuck right now. What exactly are we going to do with that original statement of Rav? Now what we just learned together is that you could write your mezuzah on cloth. Oh, so the Gemara now just all of a sudden, not all of a sudden, but the Gemara now has a light bulb. Hashad asis lahachi. So the Gemara says, now that we just realized that Rav Meir not only allows, but endorses writing mezuzah on a cloth, now we go back to Rav, and now basically, new understanding of Rav, everything Rav said is correct, just flip it. And that is L'Rav Nami, lo tema duchsusus harei k'klaf, ela ema klaf harei k'duchsusus. What he meant was that klaf is going to have the same status as duchsusus, meaning, ma duchsusus, kosher l'av mezuzah, af klaf, kosher l'av mezuzah. So just like duchsusus, you write a mezuzah on it, so too, klaf, you can write a mezuzah on it as well. So that means, vis-a-vis tefillin, so we are going to go with the simple pshat of the Mishnah and the Braisos, that tefillin can only be written on cloth. And Rav never addressed the idea that you can also write your tefillin on duchsusus. What Rav was saying, however, is that when writing the mezuzah, so although the halacha l'Moshe Mesina is that you should be writing your mezuzah on duchsusus, on the other hand, it's not limited to duchsusus. You can also write your mezuzah on cloth as well. In fact, like we learned, Rav Meir in fact endorses that practice because the cloth just simply lasts longer. It's harder and more enduring, more durable, and so therefore he actually endorses it, and that's what Rav meant from the very beginning. When he put an equivalency between them, he meant vis-a-vis mezuzah. So a mezuzah you can write on duchsusus, and you can also write on cloth as well. With that new understanding of Rav, so now that clears up the entire second amud of the daf. Let's quickly recap. We today, as much as it was an intricate daf, but in terms of summary, we really are could break down today's daf into three separate topics. The first topic was carrying receipts and loan documents that already have been used, have already been discharged. So once they've been used already and they serviced you, so then is there any value to the receipt? Tana Kama says no, and therefore for carrying on Shabbos, you're not going to be chayiv. According to Rav Yehuda, it does have value, and therefore carrying on Shabbos is going to be, according to the Tana Kama, you'd be putter for carrying it because it has no value. And according to Rav Yehuda, you'd be chayav because it does have a value, even after you used it. What's the machlokas between the Tana Kama and Rav Yehuda? So vis-a-vis the toll collector's receipt, we saw three different ways to explain it. Vis-a-vis the IOU, the note. So there we saw four different ways to explain the machlokas. Okay, and now simply not going to go through all four different ways, but that is section number one of today's daf. Section number two of today's daf, a discussion of, is there going to be a difference in shiur between processed and unprocessed? That was a question that Rava asked Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman's response was, that is not going to make a difference regarding hides versus processed and non-processed. And on that, the Gemara challenged for the remainder of the Amud Aleph, because we find in many different areas in Halacha, there is a difference between processed and unprocessed, and the Gemara made a distinction between all those cases and the case of a hide. And then, finally, last discussion of today, the Amud Beis, is a discussion regarding cloth and what are you writing on cloth. Certainly what you're writing on cloth is tefillin. Can you also write mezuzah on cloth as well? Or, the way the Gemara originally presented the question, I'm writing mezuzah on duchsustus, the interior portion of the hide. Can I also write mezuzah on the cloth as well? And this was a discussion on the Amud Beis. Rav's original statement is that when it comes to tefillin, what we thought he meant is that I could write it on cloth or I can write it on duchsustus as well. And for the Amud Beis, the Gemara significantly challenges that position all the way to the point where the Gemara acknowledges that's not what Rav meant. Rav meant the other way around. I could write mezuzah on duchsustus, which is the halacha l'Moshe Mesinai, but also I could write it on cloth as well. That's what Rav meant. And with that, we'll conclude today's daf.